From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Facebook was obliged to tighten up its privacy policy. That followed a decision in April to unilaterally loosen its privacy policy, changes that outraged privacy advocates, spurred congressional inquiry, and brought a lot of scrutiny by the media. And as the media waited for the new privacy settings to be announced, they pretty much unanimously framed the issue as privacy good, Facebook sharing our data bad.
Will your settings now be set up in a way it automatically gives you maximum privacy
yes.
at the beginning?
I think there's certainly a large number of Facebook users who basically have decided they really can't trust Facebook anymore.
Congress and privacy activists have been blasting Facebook. Hopefully that will push the ball along there. Keep our information safe.
It wasn't just the pretty people on the TV machine either. Time magazine ran a cover headline about a scary redefinition of privacy, and editorials from the New York Times to the Seattle University Spectator squealed variously in fear and outrage. Look, even the most exhibitionist Facebook users have limits as to what they'd like to share with strangers. Most of us would prefer to control our own online exposure, and some of the scenarios are genuinely spooky. Consider youropenbook.org, a website put together by a developer named Will Moffitt to make a point. The site allows you to search a term, let's say herpes, and see everybody on Facebook who mentioned the word but had never bothered to change the default privacy settings. Scrolling the results, complete with names and profile photos, is pretty horrifying.
It was a half hour's programming work. So you can be pretty sure that there are many other programmers with much worse intentions out there busy as we speak.
Pornographers, for example.
What they're trying to do is make their porn sites more interesting, less artificial, by including profiles from Facebook. I think it's rather sinister that you can search Facebook for girls in San Francisco and then display their photographs on a porn site.
Ew. Moffitt's instinct, which he seems to share with virtually the entire journalistic universe, is to assure that users control their own privacy fates. Instinct, however, fails to reckon with certain critical realities. For starters, privacy has long since ceased being an absolute. Rather, it is a commodity, which, for example, celebrities trade for celebrity, travelers trade for security, and we all trade for discounts at the supermarket checkout. In exchange for cents off on a can of soup, Safeway knows what ointments you use. But here's the thing. Safeway doesn't really care about you. They care about the anonymous you. Likewise, Facebook and Google and the other internet institutions that use your data to help advertisers target audiences. A process that saves people from spam and which, in any event, is a whole lot less intrusive than it sounds. Because, says Emory University professor Paul H. Rubin, it's just computers talking to computers.
No human knows it and no human cares about it. It's you know, we hear Google has your data and we think Google has it. Somebody must have it. There's no little man at Google who's sitting there chuckling over your symptoms or your purchases.
Furthermore, if users and especially governments overreact, let's say by mandating that sites share our data only with our explicit approval, the so-called opt-in method, then the problem will take care of itself because websites will quickly disappear. This was Randall Rothenberg, president of the Interactive Advertising Bureau, speaking on this show last year in response to the idea of everybody using an on-screen slider to meter their own privacy wishes, application by application, page by page.
People need to understand that all the seemingly free information they get, all the seemingly free email accounts, each of those comes because of advertising supporting those sites. If you're asking people to move sliders back and forth, you're pretty dramatically changing the advertising support equation that's kind of the backbone of the value proposition in American media.
Rothenberg's argument is undeniable, but so is the fear factor, that creepy notion that we are all of us being shadowed around the internet. Our most private thoughts and behavior sold to the highest bidder. Here was Federal Trade Commission Chairman John Leibowitz on our show last month.
Imagine that you were walking through a shopping mall and there was someone who was walking behind you and taking notes on everywhere you went and sending it off to anyone who was interested for a small fee. That would be very disturbing, I think, to most people.
Which is why Facebook's just announced new privacy dashboard, allowing users to set their own data sharing preferences, will be set by millions of frightened Facebookers to zero, at who knows what cost to Facebook's revenue. And thus the challenge, thus far not met, for media watchdogs to keep the issue alive so the society can make informed decisions about data privacy and the internet, but without inciting an angry mob to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. While the debate over Facebook's privacy policy has garnered all the attention, a lesser-known but far more wide-ranging battle for online privacy has also been in the works. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act governs how law enforcement officials may access information about us stored online. But the act was drafted in 1986. Remember 1986? That was the year of Chernobyl. It was the year a lady named Oprah Winfrey began her talk show, and when the most popular movie was Top Gun. In short, it was a long time ago. Most people hadn't even heard of the internet, and far fewer had actually used it. Digital Due Process is a coalition of companies, including Google and Microsoft, civil liberties groups, political organizations, and academics working to update the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, also known as ECPA. According to Kevin Bankston, a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is part of Digital Due Process, the government has easy access to much of your life online, and ECPA provides woefully inadequate protections.
The ECPA has what we think is an outdated distinction between services that provide you communications service, say your email provider or your ISP or whatever, and services that provide you storage or processing of your data. So Gmail is providing you communication service and your emails are relatively strongly protected, while your Google Doc, which you're merely storing with Google, is weakly protected such that the government could obtain your documents with only a subpoena. And in many cases, this can be done without any notice to the subscriber so that you don't even have an opportunity to try and fight that subpoena.
There is no judge he has to persuade that this document is significant for his investigation.
Exactly. Another great example of an anachronism in the law that doesn't make any sense anymore. Right now, the law, pretty clearly, requires a warrant if the government wants to get your email. But that warrant requirement only applies for emails that are 180 days old or less. And you're probably wondering, what's with this 6 months cutoff? Where did that come from?
What's with the 6 month cutoff? Where did that come from?
Well, that kind of made sense in 1986, because back then, no one stored their email with their provider. You would dial into your provider and download your email and have it deleted off the server. So if there was email sitting on an email provider's server after 6 months, it was safe to assume you'd abandoned that email and any privacy interest you might have. And so we think, and one of our principals is pushing for, removing this false and arbitrary 180-day cutoff whereby you lose privacy protection the older your email gets.
Tell me exactly what your revision of the law would require a warrant for.
Well, any content that you store or transmit through the internet, if the government wants copies of those, they need to go to court. They need to prove probable cause of a crime and particularly specify the things they want and get a judge to sign off on it before they can get it. It would also include, importantly, the logs that the search engines keep of what you search for, which has been a point of great controversy. There's disagreement about how the law currently applies there, but we can't brook any lack of clarity on that score when such sensitive records are at issue. People treat the search engine like their most trusted friend. People tell Google things that they might not tell their spouse or their priest or their doctor. And so it's very important to the coalition to strongly protect that incredibly sensitive search data.
Kevin, you're trying to get legislation, but sometimes these things are nudged along by the courts, who themselves can rule that existing law is obsolete or just plain wrong. Have there been court decisions which will support you when hearings are held on the subject of ECPA?
To the extent that there are decisions, they don't always impact how the government operates as much as we'd like them to. One good example, I talked about how under the law, the government needs a warrant for emails that are less than 180 days old. The government's position is that it can get all of your email, everything in your inbox, everything in your sent folder, everything in your drafts folder. They can get all of that without a warrant, except for those few emails sitting in your inbox that you haven't read yet. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with us and said that regardless of whether your email is opened or unopened, it's still protected by the ECPA. Despite that, the government routinely seeks emails less than 180 days without a warrant, and on occasion even will get orders from outside of the Ninth Circuit to send them into the Ninth Circuit, which includes California, where most of the email providers are based. There's the other issue of when we do get opportunities to litigate these questions, it's very common for the government to back down in order to avoid court decisions that disagree with it. We've seen this. The federal government in Colorado issued a court order to Yahoo, and Yahoo, to its credit, pushed back and said, no, we think under the law you have to get a warrant. And we at EFF jumped into that case as friends of the court. And so there were all these forces arrayed against the government in Colorado ready to litigate this question, and the government dropped its application.
So you're supposing that the government doesn't want court decisions. If they face resistance, they immediately sort of melt back into the population to fight another place, another day.
In the end, the ambiguity of the law serves the government. If they get pushback, they can just drop it and bring it up with a different judge later. And in the meantime, we're all the losers because we are deprived of clear rulings on what the law means.
All right, Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Bankston is a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Rand Paul, son of former Libertarian presidential candidate Ron Paul, became the Republican Party candidate for the Senate in Kentucky last week. He celebrated his victory by immediately making the wrong kinds of headlines. Here he is explaining to NPR's Robert Siegel why he thinks the Americans with Disabilities Act went too far.
I think if you have a two-story office and you hire someone who's handicapped, it might be reasonable to let them have an office on the first floor rather than the government saying you have to have a $100,000 elevator.
But the real headlines came after a Paul appearance later the same day with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, who performed a gentle vivisection on the brand new nominee. Maddow discovered, for instance, that Paul doesn't wholly support the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
And should Woolworth lunch counters should have been allowed to stay segregated? Sorry, just yes or no?
What I'm saying is that I don't believe in any discrimination, but if you want to answer it, you have to say then that you decide the rules for all restaurants, and then do you decide that you want to allow them to carry weapons into restaurants?
But if the media were surprised, they needn't have been. In April, Paul articulated those very same views in an interview with the Louisville Courier-Journal editorial board.
I like the Civil Rights Act in the sense that it ended discrimination in all public domains, and I'm all in favor of that.
But?
You had to ask me the but. But at the same time, I do believe in private ownership.
Why the time lag between the editorial board's stunning discovery and the reaction by newsrooms across the country? One theory, floated by The Atlantic's Joshua Green, is that the story, or lack of story, begins in the Courier-Journal's own news department. The Paul revelations didn't create a stir, Green suggests, because in Kentucky, quote, there is no longer a healthy, aggressive press corps. Candidates don't run the same kind of gauntlet they once did. The Courier-Journal's opinions page editor, Keith Runyon, says that while he can't speak for the news team, his editorial board did due diligence.
We just asked him point blank, would you have voted for the 1964 Civil Rights Act? And then he gave what turned out to be a fairly complicated answer. And we followed up by saying, but, because he hadn't told us whether he would vote yes or no. And then he went on to say that he did have a problem with that provision.
However, it didn't make that big of a splash until NPR seized on it and then Rachel Maddow on her cable program on MSNBC. It seemed to sort of slip past the world's notice. Do you have any regrets now that you didn't hit harder on this scoop in the editorial itself? I'm not suggesting you necessarily buried the lead, but you didn't call as much attention to it as you might have.
Well, I thought it was a pretty clear editorial. It was striking, for one thing, in the fact that we didn't endorse anyone in that race. I've been on the editorial board of the Courier-Journal for 33 years, and to my knowledge, we have never dodged a major endorsement, even when the choices were very unattractive. But for Dr. Pohl, that answer was the deal breaker. So I don't regret it. I wish that more people had read it and listened to it, might have picked up on it. But on the other hand, it really wasn't a huge national story yet. He was low on the radar screen. Kentucky is, you know, a relatively small state. And his opponent, the Secretary of State, Trey Grayson, wasn't about to make that an issue in his campaign because he didn't want to throw that kind of a bomb into an already complicated primary campaign.
Well, putting aside for a moment whether the national press noticed this burgeoning story in Louisville, what about your own newsroom at the Courier-Journal? I mean, that's a big story when a candidate for the U.S. Senate repudiates the Civil Rights Act, and if you follow his line of thinking to its natural extension, a whole lot of other settled law going back about a century. Was your newsroom aggressive in following this up?
Well, as you know, certainly at our newspaper and at most newspapers, there's a very strict line between church and state. And we don't have anything to do with the news coverage, and the news department doesn't do anything in terms of editorial policy setting. I have no idea what went into their thinking. I do know that we had a very tight Democratic Senate race, too, and I just couldn't answer that question beyond that.
I'm certainly not asking you to speak as an executive of the Courier-Journal because of the separation between the editorial board and the newsroom, but as a reader of the A section, did you think that the paper that you work for was late on the draw?
Not really. I mean, I thought that we laid it all out in the editorial and that the Rand Paul profile that we did get into some of his libertarian views. The fact is that who knows? I can't judge what they did and I don't know anything beyond that.
The reason I'm asking is because of a piece in The Atlantic, a guy named Joshua Green, who believes that the news side did underplay the story until it blew up in the national media. And his supposition is that the newsroom was so eviscerated by budget cuts, losing 69 editorial positions, that it just didn't even have the wherewithal to follow a huge political story or maybe even to recognize that one was brewing. Do you think there's anything to what he has to say?
No, that's ludicrous. We had a number of people. We still have, for a Gannett newspaper, we still have a very large news staff. We are profitable. We've won more awards in the last year and gotten more recognition than we have in quite a few years.
So now that you've been in the center of a bona fide media storm, learn anything about what you do for a living for having gone through this unbelievable tempest?
Well, I've worked at the Courier-Journal for 41 years, and I've lived through a lot of other tempests like Watergate and so forth. I'm very proud of this particular episode as far as our editorial page goes because if there's any issue that we've stood up for over the years, it's been the integration of America and the end of segregation, particularly in our region. And if this is a firestorm, then it's worth having.
All right, Keith. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Keith Runyon is the editor of the editorial page of the Louisville Courier-Journal. This week, police chiefs from around the country met with Attorney General Eric Holder to express concerns about Arizona's new immigration law. That's SB 1070, which gives Arizona police the power to stop anyone they suspect of being in the country illegally. The passage of the law created a firestorm around the country and was front-page material from coast to coast. Every so often, when an ongoing local story breaks out nationally, we like to speak to the beat reporters who watch the out-of-town media converge. One such, the Arizona Republic's Daniel Gonzalez, a reporter with 6 years of experience on the story and a distinct personal connection to it. He himself is Latino with an immigrant father. Gonzalez says this isn't the first time Arizona has found its immigration troubles dominating the national headlines.
The last time was, I think, 2005, when we had armed civilian patrols volunteering to go to the border and patrol the border themselves, the Minutemen groups. When that happened, we had a lot of national attention. Shortly after that, President Bush ordered the National Guard to be deployed along the border. That was in 2006. They were here for about 2 years. We've got this ongoing problem, and the national media wakes up to it, you know, every year or two when something like this happens, and there's a lot of attention, and then it kind of fades, but the problem remains.
Tell me about cable news in this current outbreak of interest attendant to the passage of the law. Has it been a caricature? Has it been fully contextualized?
What I find somewhat troubling is these kind of portrayals of Arizona has become this completely lawless, out-of-control place where the drug smugglers are just kind of running rampant, and, you know, illegal immigrants have made Arizona a very dangerous place to live. Not to diminish the problems associated with those activities. Arizona is a major corridor for marijuana smugglers, but it's not like the general population is affected by those things. There are mostly isolated neighborhoods where there are large immigrant populations, and mostly people who are involved with those kinds of activities.
Now, one gaping hole in the national coverage, it seemed to me, was failure to notice that for all of the problems that illegal immigration and the drug trade has wreaked on Arizona this past decade, that actually in the last year or two, the problems seem to have subsided somewhat. Have they not?
Yes, that's very true. I mean, back in the middle part of the last decade, when illegal immigration was peaking, the number of apprehensions along the southwest border, which, you know, includes California, Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico, was 1.2 million. And about half of those apprehensions were in Arizona. We had about 500,000 apprehensions a year. Those numbers have dropped significantly in the last 2 years. Now, in this last fiscal year, the number of apprehensions was around 500,000 along the entire border. Here in Arizona, there are around 250,000.
And not because the border is more porous and that they simply aren't being caught, but because the security measures have been increased. Do you know which is the answer?
Well, I think if you talk to the experts, they'll tell you that border security has made an impact. The more difficult it is, the more expensive it is, the more smugglers are going to charge. But the much larger factor is the economy. Most people are coming to the United States for a job. So when the economy was booming, that's when the illegal immigration was booming.
I want to ask you about some personal stuff. Your name is Gonzalez. You are the child of immigrants yourself. How has your beat been more challenging and less challenging because your name is Gonzalez?
It's more challenging because there are folks in the community who will see the name Gonzalez and presume that I will be writing from a point of view that is more sympathetic to immigrants and not include the other side. On the other hand, being Latino, I think, does give me a certain advantage. When I go out to interview folks who might be fearful of authorities, fearful of these kinds of immigration laws, and a Latino shows up at their doorstep to interview them who speaks Spanish, I do see that there is more willingness to open up to that person.
The Hispanic population is less suspicious of you. What about the Anglo population? Are they more suspicious of you?
When I've actually been talking to people who represent the side that would like to see much stricter enforcement of immigration laws, I have never detected any kind of animosity, but I do know that that does occur because we'll have callers who will call into the newsroom and they'll want to talk to a reporter about this issue. And the news assistants will say, well, our reporter who covers that is Daniel Gonzalez, and I'll transfer you to him. And the caller's response will be, I don't want to speak to a Mexican reporter. I want an American reporter.
I want to ask you, Dan, though, about one area of conflict of interest that may not be so obvious. And that is this law, which essentially mandates that police who are in contact with someone in Arizona ascertained their legal immigration status, you may well be affected, right? I mean, you may be stopped for driving while Gonzalez. And I wondered if that central fact in any way plays into how you're covering that story. At the end, is there a conflict?
No. I mean, if anything, that would help me be a better informed reporter because I can be able to describe to readers who might be skeptical that this is taking place or might not understand what's wrong about targeting people based on how they look. That helped me explain to folks why that's dangerous and why that's a problem.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Daniel Gonzalez covers immigration for the Arizona Republic in Phoenix, Arizona. In its continuing effort to assert regulatory authority over the Internet, the Federal Communications Commission earlier this month announced its intention to deem Internet service providers, like Comcast, as common carriers. The principle of common carriage goes back to medieval England, where a town's sole dock or ferry or inn was required to serve all comers and to do so at a reasonable price. The law eventually evolved to include railroads, telegraph, telephones, and so on, but at least in the United States, not the Internet. Northwestern University professor James Spetta explains why, back when President Bush's FCC had the opportunity to classify the Internet as a common carrier, it chose not to.
There was a technical reason, and then there was a broader policy reason. The technical reason is that, unlike telephone service, Internet access service comes with a variety of additional services beyond just the transportation of the communication services. Internet access providers are also providing services like caching popular websites so that those websites take less time to load, or what's called DNS service, which is the service that translates the domain name that we type in, ESPN.com, into the technical address that actually pulls up the service from a computer on the Internet.
So they're not just dumb pipes. There's value added. There's extra services, which the FCC believed distinguished them from being purely a carrier.
The position that the FCC took in the early 2000s was that these additional services made Internet access different from telephone service. And so when the FCC rethinks this issue of how to classify Internet service, they will say the fundamentally important part of Internet access service is the communications capability, and therefore it looks mostly like a common carrier service. At least that's what I anticipate the FCC will try to do.
But you said there was another reason as well. What is that?
The second broader reason that the FCC didn't want to impose common carrier regulation on the Internet was it hoped and believed that the Internet was going to be a more competitive communications medium. And in its early stages and in this developing competition, it didn't want to apply the heavy regulatory system of common carriage.
So has the court indicated whether it would look kindly on the redefinition of ISPs as common carriers?
There was an appeal of the FCC's initial decision to classify Internet access service as not being a common carrier service, and that case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's an opinion called the Brand X opinion. In that opinion, the Supreme Court said the text of the Communications Act is ambiguous. And so we think the FCC could choose either to classify Internet access service as a common carrier service or not. Its decision to classify it as not a common carrier service was upheld as reasonable. I think it fair to anticipate, based on the Supreme Court's decision, that if the FCC were to take a serious look at this question and to conclude that Internet access service is actually a common carrier service, that that would also be affirmed as reasonable. I should add, however, that that matter will no doubt be challenged in court no matter which way the FCC decides in the next year.
So if you had to make your best guess, 2 years from today, will ISPs be regulated by the FCC? Will the regulation actually be in force, or is this going to be tied up in the courts forever and ever and ever?
My prediction is that the FCC will have some regulatory authority over Internet access. What I would most like to see is for Congress to pass a new statute in which Congress makes some of the fundamental policy choices about what supervision of the internet ought to look like. In large part, this difficulty where the FCC doesn't have authority to regulate unless it's willing to call the service a common carrier service with all that implies is created because Congress hasn't readdressed communications law to really take into account the internet age. So my prediction for 2 years is that either the FCC will exercise its common carrier authority or, failing to do that, that Congress will act to give the FCC some additional authority to supervise internet access.
Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
James Spetta is a professor of law at Northwestern University. Coming up, in its 20-year history, Photoshop has produced some virtual virtuosos, also photographers who insert opinions as they click. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, using video games to promote health innovations at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. To say that photographs don't depict reality is, by now, a cliché. We all know not to trust everything we see in a photo. But in the 20 years since the release of the computer program Photoshop, it's worth noting just how far that cliché has come. Indeed, Photoshop is so ubiquitous that virtually every professional picture you encounter has been digitally retouched in one way or another. It's just so easy. And perhaps no one has played more of a role making this the norm in fashion and celebrity journalism than Pascal Dangin, who runs a studio in New York that enhances and sweetens and perfects thousands of photo spreads a year. New Yorker staff writer Laura Collins has written about Dangin, a man they call the photo whisperer.
Think of him as kind of a human oxypad. That's there's a perception in this field that he is the one person who knows exactly how a shoulder blade should look or knows exactly how to make saggy knees look beautiful in a believable way. I remember he told me in the grunge phase of fashion, he would spend hours, you know, sitting at his computer and deliberating, trying to decide which was the cool wrinkle to leave in the photograph.
And his influence is so vast that photographers actually go into a shoot, sometimes with instructions from him about what he may want for him to digitally retouch. Is that right?
I think they would say it's a collaborative process. I mean, what he is more than anything is sort of the consigliere for this generation of very successful, very powerful photographers who are either uncomfortable or indifferent to the details of how to use this digital technology that they know makes their photographs look better. So Pascal has a lot of power because of that, because of the trust that people put in him. You know, these photographers know that they can give sort of a vague mandate to Pascal, make her look more vroom. He'll push buttons on his computer. They don't really care which ones, and make that happen.
I mean, how much of this is retouching and how much of it is just sort of photo fraud?
He says that he uses the principles of anatomy and of musculature to make women look their best, but in a believable manner. So I was watching him retouch a photo spread of a very famous actress, someone we all know. And
Wait, someone we all know. You can't mention the name?
I promised him I would take it to the grave, but he did a lot of stuff to her. I mean, it was her neck, her eyes. There were things I didn't even know to be self-conscious about, like sort of these ropey blue veins on her feet had to go. But she had an endearingly crooked row of bottom teeth, and he knew better than to touch those. I mean, he said, you know, I still want her to be her.
But one of the reasons celebrities are so idolized is because they just seem so miraculous, so not so much larger than life as just better than life.
Right.
And these fashion photographs certainly help perpetuate that idea. Is he an artist or a racketeer?
I don't know. I can see both sides of it. I mean, fashion ads, they're certainly not public service announcements. On the other hand, yes, this is contributing to a totally unrealistic image of women and what they look like. His defense, like that of a bail bondsman or a repo man, would be to say, don't shoot the messenger. I'm just reflecting a desire in greater society. I think the readers of magazines know that they're looking for beauty. They're looking for glamour. They're looking for otherworldly excitement. I mean, they don't want to look at pictures of dumpy people in their pajamas who haven't washed their hair in 5 days.
Although there's a market for those too, right?
Well, I was going to say what's interesting is that at the same time this bag of tricks has gotten so much larger for the retouchers, there's also emerged the entire paparazzi industry, and the images feed each other in a way. I mean, the more perfect and flat-abbed Britney Spears looks in Vogue or in Bazaar, the more we want to see her flabby thighs on the beach in Us Weekly. I think there's an element of you're busted.
So in the annals of celebrity photo retouching, are there any cases where either Dangean or anybody else has been caught in the act crossing some sort of line?
Sort of a classic cautionary tale was TV Guide once had an issue, and Oprah Winfrey, you know, she was their cover star. People thought it was Oprah's body until Ann Margaret's husband was looking at TV Guide one day, noticed a familiar diamond on the supposed Oprah's finger and realized that it had been Oprah's head on his wife, Ann Margaret's body.
Lauren, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Lauren Collins is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her piece, Pixel Perfect, was in the magazine in 2008. In November of that year, we ran a piece about the murky ethical territory of magazine portraiture, photoshopped or not. Written profiles of politicians, athletes, and others are often accompanied by a single photo from a top-name photographer, creating opportunities for impact and mischief that we'll revisit now. Jill Greenberg is most famous for a series of pictures of toddlers crying their eyes out. She achieved these hilarious and heartbreaking Kodak moments by giving the kids lollipops, then grabbing the treats away. All right, maybe it's a little bit on the cruel side. On the other hand, the kids get over it in about a minute, and the pictures are fabulous. So suck on that one a while. Meantime, know that Greenberg photographs grown-ups, too, famous ones, on assignment for such publications as Wired, Entertainment Weekly, TV Guide, and all three major news magazines. In September 2008, she was asked by The Atlantic to do a cover portrait of John McCain. Now it happens that Greenberg despises McCain. So after capturing the heroic poses Atlantic editors were seeking, she coaxed the then-presidential candidate towards a separate lighting setup where she posed him above a strobe. This gave her the shot she was looking for, one she posted on her website. It was a diabolical McCain, awash in ghastly facial shadows. Later, Greenberg bragged to the New York Post about how easy it had been to trick him, like taking candy from a baby, you might say. Yet she doesn't know why her Atlantic editors and many others flipped out.
I do the job that's asked of me that day. And what I do beyond that is not really anyone's business. You know, especially when this election was so crucial to me and my family, I just felt, you know, maybe coloring outside the lines this one time wouldn't be such a big deal.
Assuming she can locate any line in the first place, the McCain episode was merely the latest to raise ethics questions in portrait photography, chief among them being, are there any? Where is the distinction between artistic prerogative and photo gotcha? If a picture is worth 1,000 words, who protects the subject and the audience from 1,000 words manipulated or taken out of context? The answers reside in the murk of art, journalistic comment, reader expectations, and even basic human vanity. But the topic here is potentially corrupting influences, so let's begin with the most obvious, the profit motive. The cover of a magazine is the single biggest determinant of sales.
It's very much an advertisement for the publication.
Mary Ann Golan is former director of photography for Time magazine.
Once you're choosing an image, you want the image to be arresting. You want it to stand out in all the media noise on a newsstand.
That quick newsstand scan is critical. Hence the demand for such distinctive portraitists as Greenberg, Platon, Martin Scholler, Annie Leibovitz, and the late Richard Avedon.
I think there has been a long tradition in portrait photography where photographers try to capture a person's personality rather than feeling obliged in trying to make them look good.
Photographer Martin Scholler.
The best example, I think, is Richard Avedon. I mean, you feel like he would take your picture and you would come across as mentally challenged. I don't think Avedon ever tried to please anyone but himself with his portraits.
Nor Scholler himself. His ultra-tight portraits, which have appeared in such publications as Rolling Stone and The New Yorker, are typically grim mugshots, sort of Chuck Close meets your driver's license photo. His Jack Nicholson could be a serial rapist, and his Barack Obama resembles Abraham Lincoln, homely wart and all. The shots are arty and arresting, but not exactly flattering. Although Scholler takes issue with that characterization.
I don't think my pictures are unflattering, to be honest. The light is very flattering. It's not a wide-angle lens. They're not distorted. I just think that your perception of the environment is so twisted by all these pictures that you see in magazines and advertisements that if you see a person just for who they are, you're already shocked.
Are we indeed so conditioned to the unreal world of ads and celebrity photography that we, the audience, can't handle the truth? Certainly magazine photography, at least where movie stars aren't involved, is not hagiography. It is not commissioned to flatter the subject. But whether you're JFK sitting for Karsh of Ottawa or the family next door posing in sweaters at Olin Mills, no one wants to look mentally challenged or criminal or demonic or even unattractive. So do portraitists and editors have any responsibility to their subject's basic vanity? Reporters certainly don't. If the reporting doesn't distort facts or context, nobody has a beef. Why should photography be held to a different standard?
All I can do is to try and find a human quality.
This is the photographer Platon.
And break through all these plastic walls that are put up in front of me and my sitter, and all the pressure that they try to bombard me with to stop me finding perhaps my sense of what the truth is.
Platon shot the famous Esquire photo of Bill Clinton, cat who ate the canary, grin on his face, hands on his knees, and necktie like the arrow of Eros, pointing to his notorious crotch. Platon has also famously crafted portraits of a menacing Barry Bonds, Karl Rove cowled in a sinister black aura, and a sepulchral Vladimir Putin. Platon believes it is loathsome to use digital or darkroom tricks to distort somebody's likeness, but he's cool with whatever actually happens at the shoot, such as his April 2005 Ann Coulter photo on the cover of Time magazine. The incendiary right-wing author was shot from almost floor level with a wide-angle lens, filling the foreground with her optically elongated legs. I can tell you, this is the one and only time I personally felt sympathy for Ann Coulter. She looked like a blonde praying mantis. Platon.
She's very tall, very, very slim, very skinny, and she's got these massive long legs. I mean, sure, there is a distortion, perhaps, of perspective, but this is really how I see her. I was probably a few inches away from her toes when I was taking the picture. So for her to be slightly smiling at me and leaning forward, she knows what's going on.
But did she know the effect of the wide lens?
Well, I mean, look, everybody now in the business seems to know the way I see the world. I want to pull people out of their reality and into our reality.
Out of her reality, how he sees her, what his truth is. Is that a confession or a mission statement? Time's Mary Ann Golan was on the set that day, and she thinks the latter.
I mean, if someone is a public figure and you subject them to any sort of representation, it could be a political cartoon, it could be an artist illustration, it could be a photographer, there's going to be an interpretation of that person.
And for the very reason that people are vain and self-conscious, trying to define their own interpretation of themselves for the lens, they sometimes need to be nudged or prodded or even manipulated into revealing something of themselves. Such as when Yousef Karsh pulled the cigar from Winston Churchill's mouth, like candy from a baby, and triggered portraiture's most famous scowl. In photography, this reality thing is hard to pin down. Each of a sitting's dozens or hundreds of shots is a frozen two-dimensional representation of a living, moving, three-dimensional being, a laser-sliced instant invisible in real time. It may be a reasonable likeness. It may express some aspect of mood or personality, but it is, by definition, out of context. Platon.
You could say that I'm a disturber, or I'm a professional outsider, and I come in and try to disturb the status quo.
In purely artistic terms, such sentiments are unassailable. But if a magazine writer marched into a profile interview with the announced intention of cajoling from a subject a single word or phrase that would be the sole focus of the profile, well, that's pretty much the definition of gotcha journalism. Is creating a disturbance ever a reasonable journalistic technique?
To be quite honest, I'm often surprised that I'm allowed to carry on doing what I do every day, but I haven't been stopped yet, and I'm still waiting to be sent out of the country for bad photographic behavior.
Not likely. Platon is prized by editors for the same reason he is shocking to readers. He plays havoc with our expectations. Expectations so obsessively reinforced by Hollywood and Madison Avenue that we've all been, in Platon's words, sedated with perfection. You may recall Scholler saying much the same. In magazine photography circles, this is a steady refrain. Here's Meir Rashan, founder and editor-in-chief of the now-defunct Radar magazine.
You look at any Hollywood celebrity, half of your time is spent wrangling over what they will wear. Some of them demand final photo approval. They demand certain photographers. Hollywood celebrities have a lot of power over how they're depicted in magazine covers.
The New York Times once described, for instance, Angelina Jolie's demands not only for photo approval from People magazine, but also promises about reportage in exchange for baby pictures. For self-respecting photographers and editors, that stuff is frustrating and humiliating. And one after another, they describe the impulse to assert independence. It comes up so often, you have to wonder, when a subject without the leverage to call the shots gets stung, is that entirely independence or also backlash? Consider Radar's September 2008 cover piece titled, What's So Scary About Michelle Obama? Plucked to illustrate it from the rolls and rolls and rolls of shots of a smiling future First Lady was the one moment when she stared blankly at the camera, her arms folded across her chest. The angry black woman herself. Now, the story was precisely about confronting that stereotype, so the cover photo could be justified on pertinence alone. But Obama felt hoodwinked, a fate Angelina Jolie need not fear. Is that fair? Well, maybe it is. One argument goes that a photo subject, by agreeing to the shoot, assumes all risks. Jill Greenberg.
When somebody signs up for a cover photo shoot, they're doing it for their own best interest. They're doing it for their own PR. And, you know, you have to be careful. You don't know what the story is going to be. I mean,
caveat emptor.
Exactly. It's a gamble.
Wow. Media roulette. You pays your money and you takes your chances. Moreover, Greenberg says, the wheel is sometimes rigged.
I've been assigned by magazine editors to make people look bad. You know, I've been assigned to trick my subject by magazine editors. It's just really strange. I mean, people just don't actually know the way things are.
Greenberg declined to provide details or to name names, so let's just hope premeditated photo hatchet jobs are rare. But if they aren't, how could we be surprised? When it comes to ethics or canons of conduct, the lines are maddeningly out of focus.
I went to art school, so I don't know what those canons and ethics are.
Nor is she by any means alone. I asked Martin Scholler, is there a standard of basic fairness, for example?
I think this varies greatly from photographer to photographer. I guess no is the answer.
No, Scholler hasn't gotten the memo. Greenberg hasn't gotten the memo because the memo has yet to be written. High time, I'd say. Not because these issues are black and white, but because they obviously aren't. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman and Peter Henderson, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.